You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The exploration of love in all of its many forms and fashions has been the domain of artists, poets, and philosophers since time began, but recently it has become a subject for scientific inquiry as well. In advance of Valentine's Day, we have decided to try to understand more about the biology and neuroscience of love and even what biological purposes love serves. Joining me now are Dr. Helen Fisher, research professor with the Department of Anthropology at Rutgers University, author of a number of books about love, including Why We Love, The Nature and Chemistry of Romantic Love, which is published by Henry Holt, and Dr. Sue Carter, professor of psychiatry and co-director of the Brain Body Center in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Illinois in Chicago. She's a contributing author to many volumes on social neuroscience, including Attachment and Bonding, a new synthesis published by MIT Press. Very pleased to welcome them to the show. Hello.
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 Dr. Fisher, most people will simply define love as an emotion. Is there a straightforward scientific definition of love that researchers work with?
I think that different people will give you a different definition, but I think that we've evolved three distinctly different brain systems for mating and reproduction. They overlap, but the sex drive being one, romantic love, that elation, the focused attention, the craving, the obsessive thinking of early intense romantic love, and the third is attachment, that sense of calm and security you can feel with for a long-term partner. So I think that there are basically three.
And are they equal? I mean, often somebody will say you only love me because you're sexually attracted to me, or somebody else, you know, like, this is obsessive romantic love, this is a little sick. But in the end, is love really a balance of the three?
Well, I think it can be, any one of them can be out of balance. I mean, you can become too deeply attached to somebody who you is not good for you. You can become wildly in love with somebody who has rejected you, and you can have a sexual feelings for somebody who's not interested in you. So all of them can be wonderfully, powerfully good, or really horribly bad.
You've been studying the brains of people in love. You're using MRIs?
Yes, MRI.
It's functional magnetic resonance imaging. So what happens? You mention the name of the loved one and a part of the brain just lights up?
Well, the first thing you do is you really interview them. And the brain system we're studying is intense romantic love rather than attachment or the sex drive. So I talk to them at great length, and, you know, I say, we're not studying the sex drive. Don't think about the sexual moments with this person. And I get from them, I have to convince myself first that they are intensely in love. And my first question, my most important question is, what percentage of the day and night do you think about this person? Because I think that's a central component of it. But in the machine, they do two things. They look at a photograph of their sweetheart for 30 seconds, and they look at a neutral photograph that gives them no positive or negative feelings at all. And between that positive and the neutral, we give them a distraction task. We actually show a large number, like 8,421, and for 30 seconds, they have to look at that number and count backwards in their brains in increments of 7. And this actually drives most of the blood away from some of these emotion areas so that we can get the brain in a still resting state. And then we can compare what happens in the brain when they're feeling that intense rush of romantic love with the brain in the still state. And when you cancel out what you have in common, you have the brain in love.
And there are certain parts of the brain that light up and others that don't?
Yes. Actually, some of them drain blood out. I mean, they become deactivated. I think parts of the prefrontal cortex, the behind your forehead, become deactivated. This is one of the reasons that you can make such terrible decisions when you're in love. But the most important brain region, it's a tiny little factory near the base of the brain called the ventral tegmental area. And we found activity in all of our subjects in a particular part of the VTA. And it's, in fact, the same brain region that becomes active when you feel the rush of cocaine.
Which we'll get to later, because there are all sorts of different chemicals that can affect the brain in this way. And you mentioned that you have to interview people to make sure that they're really in love, because there's an awful lot of wishful thinking.
Right.
In many cases when people are talking about love. How do you determine whether it's them projecting themselves into the relationship, and how do you determine whether it really is because they have something that might be a little healthier.
I do it in a million ways. First of all, romantic love is an intense and powerful drive. And when you are in love, you do all kinds of things. You'll laugh too much. You'll move too much. You remember all the details of what the person has said and done. You can't have a hard time eating often. You have a hard time sleeping. You can't stop thinking about the person. I'm very transparent with them. I have to be. These machines are expensive and it's very time consuming. So I basically, if I can't get to the bottom of it, I'll say, look, these are the characteristics of romantic love. Do you think you are? And they know that this is an important study. And so I haven't found anybody who was dishonest.
Let's bring Dr. Carter into this conversation. We've been talking about the brain lighting up. You look into the biochemical reactions?
Well, first I have to say that the studies I do are done in animals for reasons that are sort of obvious.
You work with prairie voles.
I work with something called the prairie vole, which is a very small rodent, comes from the great state of Illinois and the Midwestern areas where there are prairies, and it's a socially monogamous mammal.
Mm-hmm. And do they experience something akin to human love?
Well, we can't ask them the kind of questions Helen does, of course, and we really don't know. They have pretty minimal cortex, but they do interact. They have social interactions, and they form lifelong pair bonds, which is in some ways shocking, given the size of the animal and the assumptions that most of us have about where, prior to the kind of work Helen's talking about, people, I think, believed that these were cognitive processes similar to other kinds of experiences, and maybe they're driven by much older parts of the brain. So we study the brain. We study specific chemicals like oxytocin, which has gotten many people are interested in because it has effects not only on love, but also what Helen's calling love, but also attachment.
Some people call it the cuddle hormone.
Well, I think that was Natalie Angier, actually, was the person who said that, who was the writer for the New York Times. And Natalie was trying to sort of get the essence, something that people could understand about how this hormone might work, how it might affect behavior. It's sort of true that if animals have a lot of oxytocin, we can give it to them in a way that we really wouldn't normally do in humans, then they are much more likely to show prolonged contact. And contact is a very special thing for humans and animals.
Well, isn't oxytocin used in other areas as well? Wasn't that the drug that Rush Limbaugh was abusing?
No, that was oxycodone.
Oh, you see, I confuse all my oxys here.
No.
So is understanding bonding and attachment a key to understanding love?
Is understanding bonding attachment, excuse me,
a key to understanding love?
A key. Well, it's a key to the longer lasting and probably evolutionarily especially important consequences of love. So if you form an attachment and you stay in a relationship for some prolonged period of time, that relationship begins to have tremendous benefits to you, sort of obvious things like resources, but also health benefits. So, yes, the part of love that I tend to focus on, which is the bonding piece, the attachment piece, which is a bit different than what Helen's telling you about here, but equally important, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, there also are other biochemical aspects to love. I gather kissing tells us something about a person.
You're asking me?
I can ask either of you. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a song that says it's in his kiss, but I gather that saliva actually contains chemicals that allow us to sense and respond to somebody or not. And for women, the testosterone in male saliva actually can be an excitant. You're nodding your head, Helen.
First of all, hi, Sue. Nice to see you. Yes, there are traces of testosterone in the saliva. And indeed, we've now discovered that men like wetter kisses than women do. And it's thought
The estrogen that comes to them?
Probably because they're trying to inject some testosterone so that they can turn her on. I mean, that's the hypothesis. There's also traces of something called MHC, which is majohistocompatibility complex, which is part of the immune system. And it's becoming sort of well known that women are attracted to men who have a somewhat different immune system from their own in this particular part of the immune system for adaptive reasons. This particular part of the immune system is associated with the rejection of tissue, and it's thought that if you're too similar to your partner in that particular part of the immune system, you're going to have more difficulty. You might reject the fetus. So
this is hardwired into us. This would be very primitive, very ancient.
Well, you know what? I mean, there's so many forces of romantic love. I mean, I would guess that there's so many hundreds of them, and we're only just beginning to understand what those biological forces are. But let's say he's very handsome, he's got a wonderful job, he's very funny, he's dying to marry you, it's just the right time for you, comes from the right background, same level of intelligence, but the immune system's somewhat too similar.
I've always wondered why she turned me down. It was my immune system.
No, I would guess that you would overlook one factor in order to get other factors. I mean, it's all the big, ratios and balances in love and timing and luck.
Well, we are constantly evaluating the person on unconscious levels, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Not just what attracts us, but also what might make us afraid.
And I think that both Sue and I are trying to get to the bottom of some of those unconscious mechanisms that draw us to people and keep us with people.
Sue, can I call you Sue?
Certainly.
Because I've known Helen for years, so I feel more comfortable calling her Helen. Is it possible that your work and the work of others in your field will lead to the development of drugs which can actually enhance feelings of attachment and bonding?
Well, there are certainly people who think so, and there are a lot of research experiments going on around the world. Mostly, at the moment, they're being done in Europe because oxytocin is an extremely interesting molecule and has been known for many years because of its role in birth and in breastfeeding or lactation. So there was already available an intranasal spray that was used as a lactational aid in Europe. It's not on the market in the U.S. It used to be up till 1997. The company that made it, for whatever reason, took it off of the U.S. market. So
there were no political reasons or ethical reasons?
We don't know. Mm-hmm. I think the usual explanation that I've heard is that it was too costly to maintain the chemical, that particular pharmaceutical. There's some expense to keeping something on the market, and it probably just wasn't making money. But it is an interesting research tool, and it's being used a lot in Europe. Marcus Heinrichs at the University of Zurich did these amazing experiments, and there are similar ones going on that Paul Zak at Claremont College in the U.S. has done, in which they gave little intranasal spray of oxytocin and then put people into computer games that allowed them to say whether they trusted someone or how generous they felt. And in both cases, having oxytocin versus a spray that didn't have oxytocin in it gave a facilitation of the people's sense, I guess, of trust and generosity.
I've read that the birth control pill can throw off a woman's ability to sense whether or not a partner is good for her.
Well, maybe Helen knows.
To my knowledge, I think they'll choose a different kind of partner. If when you're ovulated and you're not on any kind of birth control, you're likely to gravitate to people who are more elevated activity of testosterone, which is a certain personality style. Whereas if you're on the pill or not in peak ovulation, you're more inclined to pick a different kind of man. And so it's affecting your selection process.
Now, there are all sorts of different kinds of loves. It can be homosexual love.
Right.
There's love for our child. There's a love for a sibling, for a friend. Do they all light up in pretty much the same way when you do the MRIs?
Nobody's looked, but I'm absolutely convinced that homosexual love is exactly like heterosexual love. I've done a questionnaire with 800 Americans and Japanese, and I asked a lot of questions about romantic love, and I had a subpopulation of gay and lesbians, and they answered those questions exactly the way the straights did. As a matter of fact, they had a little bit more of what I call the sweaty palm syndrome, and I think that's because there's more barriers. I mean, I'm hypothesizing, but I guess it's because there's more high barriers in the relationship, and barriers can intensify this reward system in the brain for wanting. But homosexuality is about who you love, not how you feel when you love. And so I think it's the same system.
Mm-hmm. We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more and all of our listeners' calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. My guests are Helen Fisher, who's an anthropologist and media personality, a spokesperson for chemistry.com, among other things. Recently, she's been studying the brain in love using fMRIs. Sue Carter is a psychiatrist who studies the endocrine system and bonding in prairie voles. But we should also point out she knows a lot about human love, I guess partly because you're married, but also because your husband is working on a book about love.
Well, yes, and first I have to say I'm a professor of psychiatry for no reason that's clear to me, but I'm actually a biologist, not a psychiatrist, and that's a pretty big distinction. So I look at the world from sort of biological points of view. And yes, it's true, my husband and I are working on a book we're calling The Love Code at the moment, and I think what will be a little bit different about that book and from sort of what's already known is that it will talk more about sort of the emotional, deep emotional components of love and the process that Steve, to whom I've been married 38 years, calls neuroception. Steve Porges is my husband. And neuroception is a process where you identify kind of probably unconsciously the emotional features of another person or a situation. And so we have very ancient pre-cortical parts of our brain that are allowing us to decide whether it's safe or not to be with another. These, I think, are fundamental pieces of the love code and the sequence that then allows you to form a long-term relationship.
We'll come back to more of that and our listener calls after we take a little break. As I said, my guests are Sue Carter and Helen Fisher. We're talking about the neurophysiology of love. Back with Please Explain and our guests, Sue Carter and Helen Fisher. We're talking about love on a more scientific level than we normally think of it, although the science is explaining all sorts of things that have been inexplicable to me. For example, and we'll be taking calls, by the way, in a few moments. Our number here is 212-433-9692 if you want to join in the conversation. But we got a listener comment, and this is something that I wanted to get into, so I really think it's interesting. She writes, I'd like to hear the addiction to the crazy obsessive love talked about. I find that many of my friends are simply addicted and unable to proceed to the more stable love. They need their fix. They have nothing but intense short affairs, which always end in disappointment, and many eventually that if they're not going crazy obsessed over someone, they lose interest. This leads to the way women say things like, I only have good sex with bad men. The good men are boring in bed. I maintain that they're simply not getting their fix and wouldn't know true love from their elbow. What do you say, Helen?
After I and my colleagues put the 17 people who were madly in love and happily in love into the brain scanner, we then put in 15 people who had just been rejected in love. And I came to really believe that romantic love is an addiction, a wonderfully positive addiction when it's going well and a really horribly negative one when it's going poorly. And in fact, we're finding out what's going on in the brain when you have been rejected and when you just want this person. You're willing to take enormous risks. You know, romantic love has all
people get sick when they're rejected.
Oh,
often.
Sure.
But they get sick when they're in love and they get sick when they're rejected. Is it a different sick?
A little bit differently, yeah. Well, you know, when you're madly in love, you're enormously energetic and optimistic and you lose weight and you can really focus, not always on the right thing, but you can focus on your partner anyway. But when you've been rejected in love, I mean, what people will do when they've, I mean, the risks that they're willing to take, the dependency, romantic rejection has all of the characteristics of an addiction. You distort reality. You become very dependent. You're totally focused on your drug. You crave the person. You go through withdrawals. And you go through relapse. I mean, you know, you're suddenly driving along in your car, and it's months later, you're getting over it, and you suddenly hear a record on your car radio, and boom, you're right back into that craving. So it can be a real addiction. And I think that, you know, there's a real downside part of love.
Well, there's a piece in today's Wall Street Journal that involves your research.
Right.
And this is people who have been in love for a long time. You went back to people who have remained in love for 10 years. Is that addictive, or is that something? Is that just stable?
We're now putting people into the machine, Art Aaron, Lucy Brown, Bianca Alcevedo, myself, and others, who say that they are still in love after 10 years of marriage. As a matter of fact, I put two of them in myself. One of them had been married almost 25 years. And he has maintained for years that he's in love with his wife, not just attached, but in love. And sure enough, we looked at his brain, and we found activity in a brain region associated with intense romantic love, and Sue's going to like this, in a brain region associated with deep attachment in prairie voles, the ventral pallidum, and also a brain region associated with the sex drive. So in him, all three of these brain systems seem to be active. So you can sustain romantic love, but you got to pick the right person, and you've got to do certain things to maintain romantic love, too, and attachment.
Now, your study, Sue, of voles is because they're monogamous?
Well,
how long do they stay together?
How long do the voles stay together?
Yeah.
They stay together until one is dead. They literally until death parts them in nature.
And none of them ever fool around?
Well, I didn't say that, did I?
Oh.
The nature of the relationship, I have to go back to what's meant by monogamy, because humans use the word monogamy often to mean sexual exclusivity. But the way voles use it, and so far possibly all other mammals, humans included, we form deep bonds, and it's these bonds that are important, and sexual exclusivity is there if the bond's successful in keeping it there, but it's not an intrinsic part of monogamy. I know this is shocking, and shocked me. I took about 10 years of time in the studies I was doing to prove to myself that, in fact, I believed that monogamy was monogamy. I was just as engaged in the idea as anyone else, but when we studied the animals carefully, we could see that they really did care who they sat by, who they were with, who they spent time with. They were less particular about who they had sex with.
And Helen, this is an area of study that you engaged in many years ago.
Yes,
I remember when we
right.
first talked, it was about why people stay together and why they don't stay together.
Right. You know, when Sue uses that term social monogamy, and what she's really, you know, referring to is the fact that they will sit together and be together and make a territory together and create a family and a life together. But there's data on over 100 species, and they've not found one so far when they really looked who doesn't have some degree of adultery. So I came to believe many years ago that we have what I would call a dual reproductive strategy, a tremendous drive to pair up and rear our children as a team, but also a tendency to be adulterous, to do divorce, and to remarry, what I call serial monogamy and clandestine adultery. Now, we all play this game somewhat differently. We have different childhood experiences, and we've got different brain structure and physiology. But I've looked in 40 societies, and we find adultery in everyone. By the way, adultery in America seems to be going down, if one can really ever study adultery. And the reason
Well, you have
is,
to trust what people tell you.
Yeah, and that's questionable because they even lie to themselves. But the reason we think that it's going down is that 100 years ago, you really couldn't divorce, and so you would have somebody on the side. But today, people will often choose to solve one relationship before they get into another.
Well, I've never had sex with that woman.
Yeah.
Amy from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering how the hormonal changes in perimenopause and after menopause affect all this physiology.
Well, I can tell you what it does to some of the basic hormones, including oxytocin, which goes down a bit during the menopause, because it's an estrogen-dependent molecule. So if a woman does not take extra estrogen, she will sort of inevitably have less oxytocin, probably, although whether that's critical to being in love, we don't know, or to even maintaining love relationships, we don't know.
You know, just to add to that, I've looked at human pair bonding in 97 societies through the demographic yearbooks of the United Nations. And as it turns out, the older you get, the less likely you are to divorce. And so we are seeing this aging world population. And by the way, the divorce rate is down in America. It's now down to 43%. It was up to 50% in 1981, and it's down to now to 43%. And that's partially in part because I think of this aging world population.
So although sex might diminish because of changes in our hormonal systems, the attachment remains strong or may even become stronger?
It appears so. I mean, when you look at these United Nations data, it appears to. Now, some people will say it's just a matter of lethargy, or but I think that these days most people do.
Too hard to divide the books and records.
There you go. But, you know, today in America, we are looking for a different kind of marriage. We're looking for what they call companionate marriage, a peer marriage or a symmetrical marriage, a marriage between equals, people who play together, work together, think together. And in that kind of relationship, you know, that's not the way it always used to be. I mean, in former generations, your first allegiance was to God and to the larger community and to the kin group. And today, we're not looking out as much. We're looking in. Our primary relationship is becoming the core aspect of our lives.
Amy, thank you so much for calling us.
Thank you.
And Lou from NIAC. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there, Leonard. Great show. As always, you know, these voles, as an aside, the voles, they managed to do this pair bonding without the aid of chocolates and Hallmark cards.
And they don't do much vole playing either.
That's very good. Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering, and it's probably an obvious question, because Leonard's questions are much more insightful than mine could ever be.
Oh, stop it.
But I was wondering how much culture and race managed to sort of override the chemical love thing.
Yeah, to some degree you've been alluding to that, Helen.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it has so much to do with race, and I think it does have to do with culture. I've looked in 20 cultures, societies, and around the world where women are more economically powerful and more equal with men, both men and women are more likely to leave a bad relationship in order to make a good one. Why? Because they can. Very often in very poor parts of America, the women are the ones who have the opportunities to get various jobs, and the men don't. And when you have an inequality and one individual, particularly the woman, is making a great deal more than the man, she's likely to leave a bad relationship. So culture will always play a role.
Thank you so much for your call. You wanted to add something, Sue?
I was going to say that, remarkably, prairie voles have culture, too, and even within the same species, different kinds of early experience can determine, in some way we have yet to identify, the later ability to form a pair bond or not.
So nature and nurture apply to voles as much as they do to humans?
Yes.
Wow. You know, you would think that it's all nature with animals below, I guess, the primate level, but obviously that's not true.
Well, nature, I mean, experience is translated into physiological, and even now we know sort of long-lasting changes in gene expression. So there is a biology to experience, and there's a biology to nurture.
So Linnaeus was right, after all? I was told that that he was wrong, that species couldn't change just because of experience.
Well, Francis Champagne, Michael Meany, who have been studying these things together for years, have shown that you can, that early experience, at least in rats, has the ability not only to change gene expression, the ability, in other words, the capacity of a gene to produce a new product, not only within the life of an animal itself, but it can be passed on through generations.
Wow.
So Linnaeus was right. He was right.
I have to go back and tell my old biology teacher that she was giving me misinformation. Jezra from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I'm a big fan of Dr. Fisher's, and it's great.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for all the great writing and great
thank
work.
Thank you.
And it's great to hear about Dr. Carter's work also. I wanted to ask you both, do you think that we'll ever have a kind of a modern love potion? What would the equivalent of, you know, the fairy dust from Midsummer Night's Dream be, based on your research?
You want to start, Sue?
Well,
Okay. Some people would like oxytocin to be the answer to your question, and I think it's much more complex than that, and we probably, most of us, don't need anything from the outside world. What we need instead is to first have a set of life experiences that don't produce such a high level of anxiety that we can't form any kind of relationships. And then we also need to be able to sort of evaluate. We do need our brain, we do need our cortex, in order to evaluate situations and pick partners that are capable of allowing us to get into safe relationships. And these are things that oxytocin may be able to sort of jumpstart, but I'm not sure we really want them to. I personally don't want anyone giving me a molecule that determines who I fall in love with or who I trust.
You know, I'm just to add to this, I'm studying why you fall in love with one person rather than another. Match.com, the internet dating site, came to me 3 years ago and asked me to create a new dating site, and it's called chemistry.com, and I created a questionnaire, and I guess 3.7 million people have actually taken this questionnaire in America, and I'm watching.
That's a broad sampling.
Yeah, isn't it amazing these days that you can do this? And I'm watching which biological types have an instant attraction to other biological types. But to answer your question, there's too many forces in it. I don't think there's ever going to be a love potion because, you know, we tend to fall in love with people when the timing is right, when somebody who's nearby, somebody who's mysterious, somebody who's the same general level of education and intelligence and good looks, somebody from the same socioeconomic background and ethnic background, somebody who shares your religious values, somebody who has a different immune system. Somebody, if you're high on estrogen, you're likely to gravitate to somebody who's high on testosterone. If you're high on serotonin or express certain genes in the serotonin system, you're likely to attract people like yourself. There's so many forces, both cultural and biological, and I don't think there's any potion that can give a long-standing, you know, really adjust the brain long-term to make you fall in love with somebody and stay in love with.
And there's something coercive about the thought. Aphrodisiacs would make most of us really uneasy if they actually worked.
And they wouldn't work for long. It would wear off. I mean, we know that the dopamine system is associated with intense romantic love. Well, you can up your dopamine by taking various pills. And let's say you do go out and take cocaine and get a big rush of cocaine, you know, of dopamine during the course of the evening, and perhaps even do find somebody very attractive. Well, what about the following morning? I mean, you can't take cocaine every day and remain a vital member of society, you know, and have babies and, you know, go to old age. So it just, around the world, by the way, people have looked for love potions, though, everywhere on Earth.
I'm still testing out number 9. It doesn't seem to be working. Barbara from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air. Bobby, I have to turn down your radio because we're on a slight delay here. Barbara, are you there?
Hi, thank
you. Yeah, you have to turn it off.
Okay, all right. Thank you. Hi, sorry, I was listening so that I could hear you. My question is, you had mentioned something about women being on the pill, making different choices in the kind of men that they choose than women who are not, but that was not expanded on. I wanted to have an answer to that.
The person to ask is Dr. Lionel Tiger. He did some basic work on it, but if you want to email me at helenfisher@helenfisher.com, I can begin to look that up and give you more a more detailed response. But this has been known for some time that, by the way, other kinds of chemicals are going to adjust this too. I mean, people who are taking Prozac or Paxil are driving up the serotonin system. Are not only killing the sex drive in many cases, but I think they're jeopardizing your ability to fall in love and to stay in love because these three brain systems of romantic love and attachment and the sex drive are connected. And as you tussle with one, you are going to jeopardize the other. So I think we're going to come, as we understand these brain systems, and of course Sue and I are trying to do that and others are too, I mean, that's the value of this research, understanding how our environmental stimuli affect these systems in both good and bad ways.
Thank you for your call. If you want to add anything, Sue, you can just jump in at any time.
Okay, well, let me say something about medicine in general as a way of modulating behavior. What happens is that a drug sort of cuts off the feedback loops that are normally there. And love, of all the things we do in life, has more activity, more change, more need to be dynamic. So anyone who thinks that they're going to make it better with a drug, as Helen has very, very well stated, is likely to be disappointed because the drug can't adjust to the changes in the environment and the changes in your own brain chemistry.
Sophia from Harlem. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was calling because it has everything to do with the chemistry that we're talking about, and going back to what you were saying about saliva and how you can basically, you know, someone can be good on paper and have all these, you know, all their ducks in a row, but, you know, after a kiss, you can feel as though the chemistry just isn't there. And I was wondering if that holds true more for women than for men, or if that's equal for both sexes.
You know what? The answer to that is in 2 weeks ago, the issue of Time magazine, on the cover was The Science of Romance, and I read it that myself. It's not my basic research, and I can't remember whether it was more men or more women, but it was dramatic. I think I recall it was more than 50% of both of them had an experience in which the person was perfect on paper. In fact, they really felt an attraction, and then they kissed him, and that was the end.
Do you think it's why some people will say he was a bad kisser?
Yes.
When, in fact, the next
Not
woman thinks he was a perfectly wonderful kisser.
Absolutely. Yeah. Magic. There's still magic to love.
Well, I'm not sure that we've answered all the questions because I'm not sure all the questions are yet answered. But this is something that I would like to pursue further. I think we are all interested in varying degrees as to why we fall in love and why we fall out of love and why some people attract us. I know the big the question for so many people is, why in this room is this the only person who I really feel drawn to when those other people seem to be perfectly fine?
I think that's the last really big unanswered question, and that's what I'm trying to look at chemistry.com. And I am finding patterns, and I bet that Sue's book is finding patterns too.
Well, we can get some of the answers by asking our very ancient autonomic nervous system, you know, heart rate changes, emotion. We're talking about sweaty palms. All of these kinds of things are clues to this deeper process that Steve Porges calls neuroception. So we see other people and we sense them, and we make almost automatic decisions about whether that person is someone that we can be close to or not. Now, when we get close, we then have this other level of screening, perhaps this chemical levels and behavioral levels. But just that one moment when you decide, is this person scary or not? And fear is the most primitive of our human emotions. We know when to get away. Our body knows when to get away. So, and this is another case where you really don't want chemicals to get in the way. You don't want to be drunk or on some kind of...
Sue, I hope you're not going to feel rejected, but I've got to get away now.
Good night.
We've run out of time.
Goodbye.
Thank you both so much, Sue Carter of... the professor of psychiatry and co-director of the Brain Body Center in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Illinois in Chicago, and Helen Fisher, research professor with the Department of Anthropology at Rutgers University. Her latest, is it your latest book, Why We Love?
Yep, Why We Love.
Published by Henry Holt.
Thank you
so much. Thank you.